Okay, so in today's lecture, he will address something that I had indicated earlier, which is that in curved space-time, the vacuum state is a rather non-trivial state. And first, I should clarify what we mean by the vacuum state. By the vacuum state, we mean the no-particle state. Now, there's reason to believe that in a generic curved space-time, there is no such state. No state that reasonably could be called a no-particle state. Because if the universe was to expand here and shrink over there, you just can't find a state that would be no particle. However, in Friedmann-Robertson-Walker-Lemaître space-times, to a very good approximation, we can identify what the vacuum state is. Or we can identify a state in the Hilbert space, which, to a very good approximation, is a state that describes no particles, from the perspective of an observer who travels with the general Hubble flow. An observer that doesn't himself or herself is accelerated in any way, is not doing any non-trivial motion. And as we discussed briefly earlier in this course, that vacuum state is not going to be the state of lowest energy of the field. Now, that difference is something quite non-trivial, and we will start it today, and we will complete that investigation next time. Let's see how far we got. Remember that we can solve the quantum field theory on a given background space-time in infinitely many ways, but each looks like this. We have mode functions, vk, and we use those mode functions to express our field chi. Remember, chi is not the physical field, it's rescaled. To express our field chi in terms of the mode functions and creation and annihilation operators. So we can write our quantum field as some prefactor and then mode function times A operator, mode function times A dagger operator. What makes this non-unique is the fact that we can use many different choices of mode functions. That choice is not unique. Whenever we do make a choice, then we have the field expressed in, let's say, in such a way. Then with the choice of mode function comes, of course, also the choice of A and A dagger operators. And what we discussed before is that if we choose to express chi using different mode functions, then of course there are going to be different A and A dagger operators as well, because the whole thing must add up to the same left-hand side. We also discussed that these V and V tilde mode functions must be expressible in terms of the untilded V. And so the V and V star is expressible in terms of the V tilde and V tilde star and vice versa. And similarly, the A and A dagger operators can be expressed in terms of the A tilde and A tilde dagger operators. That this is so is guaranteed by the fact that this is equal to that, but also equal to this, and that they are acting on the same Hilbert space up to a change of basis by the Stone-von-Neumann theorem, at least if we carefully work with ultraviolet and infrared cutoffs. So in practice, this was relatively easy once we boiled it down to individual modes. Remember that we chose the momentum representation, we did a Fourier transform in space, and a key benefit of that was that the Klein-Gordon equation decoupled. Instead of being a partial differential equation that involves derivatives with respect to many variables, we obtained simply ordinary differential equations that involved only the time derivatives for each momentum, and the momenta were no longer mixing. And that meant that for each momentum, for each mode, we have a choice of mode functions, but they are now no longer drawn from an infinite dimensional space of possible mode functions, but just from a three-dimensional one. And in particular, if we make a choice of mode function, V, for a particular mode, K, and compare that to another choice of mode function, let's say V tilde, then we must have that the V tilde solution, that the V tilde mode function is expressible as a linear combination of the V and the V star. So these complex number coefficients here, alpha k and beta k, are called the Bogoliubov alpha and Bogoliubov beta coefficients. Remember, a mode function is a mode function if it solves the Klein-Gordon equation and the Wronskian condition. There you go. Right. Okay. Now the Bogoliubov transformation for the mode functions translates into a Bogoliubov transformation for the A and A dagger operators that also involves these alpha and beta coefficients. It's a little exercise to prove that this is how they are related. And then we said, aha, if we can express the annihilation operator A in terms of the annihilation and creation operators A tilde, then we can use this to calculate the unitary transformation from one Fock basis to another Fock basis. The trick is this: the defining equation for the vector 0 is, without a tilde, is that it is annihilated by the AK operators with the A without a tilde. But we can now express the A tilde, the A operator, in terms of the A tilde operators. So therefore, we know that the tilted operators act on the vector 0 here in this particular way. That equation can be solved. We can make an answer for what this vector is in terms of the tilted basis vectors. We made an answer and found that the solution is this. So what we have here is that we can express this basis vector from the untilted basis in terms of the basis vectors of the tilted basis. See, this is now a linear combination of lots of terms. Why a linear combination? Well, you see, you have the exponential here, which involves an infinite series. So you get lots of terms, sums of terms, where A daggers act on, where A dagger tildes act on the zero tilde. And so therefore, all sorts of basis vectors are being produced here. And what we see is that the untilted vacuum is a linear combination of basis vectors that involve arbitrarily high excitations of the state 0 tilde. But since we now can express the vector 0 in terms of the basis, the tilted basis vectors, we can also express the vector 1 without a tilde in terms of those, because all we have to do is act with the A dagger without a tilde on that. That will give us the 1 vector for a particular momentum, and then have it act on the right hand side too, and so we get the representation of that. We can do this because we know how the A dagger K operator without the tilde acts on the K basis vectors because of this. If we take the Hermitian conjugate of that equation, we get AK dagger, and here we get correspondingly whatever the dagger does. And so on the left-hand side, we apply the A dagger, get the one state, and on the right-hand side, we have this stuff acting here. So we can explicitly write down how every basis vector in the untilded basis is a linear combination of basis vectors in the tilded basis. So we have that complete unitary transformation. Now, here's an example scenario for when this is useful. So let's say we pick two times in the evolution of the universe, eta 1 and eta 2. Remember, eta is the conformal time. So we pick two times, an early time and a late time. And let's say we are concerned with the physics at early time, eta 1. Then what mode functions should we use then to express our quantum field? Well, the idea is, it is convenient then, while working at early time eta 1, to choose mode functions, let's call them vk of eta, that are such that the corresponding untilded vector 0 is the vacuum state at time eta 1. We don't have to, but it's convenient. Remember that these mode functions, though, are functions of the time. So they are functions for all time, infinite past, infinite future, if there's an infinite past and an infinite future. Some cosmologies have a finite beginning or a finite end, or both. So in any case, the mode functions are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation for all time. So if we want to do physics around the time eta 1, we choose a set of mode functions, namely for all k, such that by some criterion that we have still to determine, the vector 0 is the vacuum state at time eta 1. And then at the later time eta 2, by the same reasoning, we will find it convenient to choose at time eta 2 a different way to represent our quantum field using different mode functions, using therefore different A and A dagger operators, namely tilded ones, again such that the tilded vector 0, 0 tilde, represents the vacuum state, represents the vacuum at the later time eta 2. Keeping in mind that those two may not be the same Hilbert space vectors. And therefore, the two sets of solutions that we choose may not be the same. If, of course, we're dealing with Minkowski space, then the choice of mode functions should be the same in both cases, and therefore also the A and A dagger operators would be the same, and therefore also the vector that's annihilated by the A operators would be the same. But otherwise, we would have particle creation. Why particle creation? Well, let's assume that the system is prepared in the vacuum state at the early time eta 1. So let's say omega, capital omega, is the state of the quantum field, and it will always be the state of the quantum field until we do a measurement, because it's a Heisenberg picture. So let's say that the state of the quantum field, omega, is that vector 0 at early times. So remember, it's going to stay that. And then, if at time eta 2, it turns out that these mode functions that we need to use in order to have that the vector 0 tilde is the vacuum then, if that's not the same mode function as this mode function, then the A and A dagger operators are not the same as the tilded ones, and the vector 0 tilde is not the same as the vector 0, and therefore there is this non-trivial transformation between them. And therefore, the state of the quantum field, it still hasn't changed, which is still the vector 0 without a tilde, is no longer the vacuum, because it is at eta 2 different from what is the vacuum at eta 2, which would be the state 0 tilde. And we would get lots of particles, as we can see here. The state of the quantum field is a linear combination of excited states at late time. And as we discussed, what this does is describe the creation of particles out of the vacuum in pairs, always with the momentum k and the momentum minus k in pairs. How much particle creation do we get in this way? In fact, if you remember, this was an exponential, and therefore it contains arbitrarily high powers of A daggers. And that means that what used to be the vacuum state, the state of the field, it contains in principle a probability amplitude for finding arbitrarily large numbers of particles. But does that mean that we actually will find arbitrarily large numbers? I mean, see, this exponential has this to the power of a million in it, to the power of a billion. But of course, multiplied with a prefactor here. And the exponential also has a factorial in the denominator. So we'll have to work out what that actually means for particle creation. So what we see, first of all, from that equation is that in principle, if any particles are being created here, then there is always a finite probability of finding any number of particles. But that doesn't mean that necessarily infinitely many particles are predicted. But we have to be a little bit careful here. On one hand, particle production is super important because if too many particles were to be created, then that could slow down the expansion, for example. Or, well, it could be so much that it contradicts the evidence. We don't see particles being created out of the vacuum, at least not at the present time, or not the past few billion years. But on the other hand, it is clear that if there's any particle production at all, it's infinite if the universe is infinite, right? Even if there's the smallest density of particles that's being created, if you multiply that with an infinite volume, the total number is going to be infinite. So what we really should do is work with an infrared cutoff, work with a huge box, and then get a finite number of particles, and divide that by the volume and get the density in this case. What we're really talking about is the density of particles that's being created here. All right, let me remind you of something. For a harmonic oscillator, the operator A dagger A is called the number operator. You've probably all seen that, right? And it is a self-adjoint operator, a self-adjoint observable. And it has the property that when it acts on an n-fold excited state, it reproduces that n-fold excited state with an eigenvalue of n. Therefore, it is counting how many excitations there are in the harmonic oscillator. If you haven't done the calculation yet, just do it at some point. You just substitute for n hat a dagger a in here and then use the commutation relations and you get that. So n is a self-adjoint operator, and its spectrum is the natural numbers. In quantum field theory, we have infinitely many number operators. Namely, for every mode, we have a number operator. For every mode, we have a harmonic oscillator, and each of those harmonic oscillators has a number operator. So what's then the interpretation of this number operator in quantum field theory? Well, let's assume that at some time eta, the state zero is the vacuum state, is the no particle state. So therefore, at that time eta, the state where A dagger K acts n times on that is a state with n particles of momentum K, right? If the nth oscillator is excited, if the K oscillator, the K-mode oscillator is excited n times, then we say we have n particles of momentum K. Now, let's assume that at some time eta, the system is in an arbitrary state, which doesn't have to be the vacuum state or a cleanly n times excited state. It's just an arbitrary state, omega. Then we can ask, what's the expected value of the number of particles of momentum K that we would find if we looked for them, if we measured them. So if we measured this observable n hat K, well, as usual in quantum theory, Just take that number operator of whom we want to know the expectation value, well, and calculate the expectation value. Here's the quantum field theoretical state, and here's the quantum field theoretical operator. Just work that out. So in particular, n hat, remember, is a dagger a. It's a dagger k, a k. If you choose for the state of the field to be the vacuum state, well, then you have the a operator acting on the vacuum state, annihilating it, and you get really a zero here. In general, of course, it's going to be some coherent superposition that you get. So the expectation value of the number operator, as usual described with a bar over the observable, is just the expectation value calculated as usual. Now, in our above scenario, where we start out the quantum field in some state, and then let the dynamics run, and then we want to know how many particles have been created in our box. Remember, we work with an infrared cutoff. So our k values are discrete because it's all happening in a box. We want to know how many particles did we create in that box at the later time eta 2. Then here's how we can calculate that. We take the number operator, n tilde k, made out of the ak tilde and the ak tilde dagger operators, which are the operators that built the Fock basis on the vacuum state at time eta 2, right? At the later time, we have the tilde operators. So the n tilde operator counts particles at time eta 2. We want to know its expectation value. So we take the state of the quantum field, capital omega, which may or may not have been, for example, the vacuum state at eta 1, and we plug in this number operator of time eta 2. Then in our case, from what we just chose, the capital omega was the vacuum state at the time eta 1, so therefore it was this state, right? It's the state 0. And the tilde number operator is expressed in terms of the tilde a and a dagger operators. So this is what we need to work out. And you see, it's non-trivial because the state doesn't have a tilde on it. It was fixed at time eta 1. But the number operator, we want to measure at time eta 2, where it's the tilde 1. And we don't, I mean, the action of a tilde on the 0 without a tilde is non-trivial. So that's something non-trivial to work out. But not very hard, because we have the Bogoliubov transformation. We know that the A can be expressed in terms of the A tilde and A tilde dagger operator, and vice versa, in this way. And I leave it to you as a little exercise to calculate this from that. You just have to solve this. You know, just take this equation, take its Hermitian conjugate, and then solve for the relevant variables, and you get this. Okay, so all we need to do is substitute the expression for a tilde in here. And of course, this is all very abstract. Later we will see how to calculate the alphas and the betas. So far we just know they must exist. But then for an FRW spacetime, depending on how it expands, whether it is de Sitter or whether it is some power law inflation and so on, you get different alpha and beta coefficients. Okay, so for now, we just know they must exist, these numbers, alpha and beta. So then the number expectation value comes out this way. We substituted the tilde quantities in here. And then you see that now the operators don't have tildes, and this vector doesn't have tildes. So we know how these things act on each other. We know, for example, that this term annihilates that. So we can just cross out that term. And similarly, we know that the dagger operator here annihilates to the left, so we can cross out that term as well. So this means that this term with the alpha dies, and that one with the alpha tilde dies. So we only have this operator having a chance to give something finite, and that operator having a chance getting something finite. So we end up with only terms that contain the beta. So what we see is that the particle creation is determined by the Bogoliubov beta coefficients. I think we saw that earlier in the previous lecture too, that it's the beta coefficients that matter for Bogoliubov transformations. It's the beta coefficients that can describe particle creation. If, for example, you just rotate your quantum field theory, you get beta coefficients, but they're going to be alpha only, because you're not changing the vacuum. If you don't see particles in this setup, then if you just rotate your experiment, you still don't see particles. No particle creation, no beta coefficients. Okay, so the modulus squared of the beta coefficients gives us the expectation value of particle creation here. Let's keep that in mind, that's important. So then, what is the total particle number created in our box? Well, the total number operator is the sum of the individual number operators for all of the individual modes. So we just need to sum up all of those expectation values. And that means we have to sum up the moduli squared of all the beta coefficients. A few remarks. Remember, we assumed here an infrared cutoff so that the k's are discrete. And that helps because we then have to sum instead of integrating, but also it's the only way in which we have something finite. That's not zero, not infinite. Because if space-time was infinite, if the box we're considering is infinite in volume, then of course any particle production will lead to a total number of infinity. Okay. And not only do we want a finite number of expected particles, but also a finite amount of energy that has been pumped into the field in this way. See, if you have particle creation through the non-trivial expansion of space-time, then these particles carry energy, and if a lot of particles are being created, then the quantum field carries a lot of energy. And at some point, that is no longer negligible, because energy gravitates. So therefore, if through the expansion a lot of particles have been created, then also a lot of energy has been pumped into the quantum field theory, and that eventually would need to be taken into account, and that information would then have to be fed back into our assumptions about how the space-time is expanding for consistency. But for now, we are sticking to that regime where there is not that much particle production, so that we can simply say, okay, the universe is expanding in a particular way for some reason, and we are just considering a quantum field that goes along for the ride, but that doesn't really impact how the space-time is expanding. We will later improve on that picture, of course. Now, in the discussion so far, we simply assumed that we have a way to pick or to identify which vector in the Hilbert space is the null particle vector. And we said once we have that criterion, then we apply it. For example, at eta 1, we choose our mode function such that the vector annihilated by A is that mysterious vacuum vector. And then at time eta 2, we would do the same thing. We apply our criterion for identifying the vacuum state and then make sure that we choose the right mode function such that the vector annihilated by the A tilde is the vacuum state. How do we know which is the vacuum state? How do we know which state in the Hilbert space is the null particle state? In principle, there are infinitely many candidates, right? There is zero, there is zero tilde, there is zero double tilde, etc. These are all the vectors that are annihilated by some annihilation operators corresponding to some mode functions. Whenever we make a choice of mode functions, we get a choice of potentially the vacuum state. But which mode function should we choose? Which vector that is associated with the mode function is the null particle vector? Now, one thing that we at this point should keep in mind, and It's a very important connection. If we make an assumption about a particular vector zero being the null particle state, this is equivalent to making an assumption about which mode function we should choose. Right? I'm not saying something new, I'm just emphasizing what we had before. I'm just saying that with every set of mode functions comes a set of ANA Dagger operators. Right? So the candidates for the vacuum state are vectors that are annihilated by ANA Dagger, by A operators, right? And these A operators come along with the choice of mode function. So in other words, identifying which vector in the Hilbert space is the vacuum state is the same mathematically as identifying which mode function we should choose. Very important that we keep that in mind. The vacuum identification criterion that we will have to develop is a mode function identification criterion because it's one-to-one correspondence. So what we will see is that if a vacuum at some time eta exists at all, and as I said, there's reason to believe that in a generic curved spacetime, there really isn't a state that is a null particle state in an uncontroversial state, in an uncontroversial way. But for FRW spacetimes, there is. Well, then we can find a suitable mode function that does the trick. I mean, its A operator will be the one that annihilates this vacuum state. So that we can write the quantum field in this way, and then this A operator annihilates what we identified as the vacuum state. But how to identify now that vacuum state? See, all I wanted to say in the previous slide was our task is to identify the vacuum state. Mathematically, this will be translating into identifying a preferred choice of mode function. Right? That's just the same mathematically. So how do we specify what the vacuum state is? How do we identify the vacuum state? Oh, on this slide too, I'm just making the point that picking out a potential vacuum state is to pick out a mode function. And now comes a very technically very important step. Picking out a mode function is equivalent to picking out two numbers. Because a mode function is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. And therefore, in order to specify it, we don't have to specify it everywhere. We just have to specify it at two points, or at one point and its derivative. Because the Klein-Gordon equation is a second order in time equation, we only need two boundary conditions. Which means that even though a mode function, being a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, can look terribly complicated. For example, if the space-time is expanding and then shrinking and expanding and all of this in a wild way, then the mode functions, each of them, will look very complicated. But being a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, it suffices to know what its amplitude is at a particular point in time and what its derivative is at a particular point in time. It's in the Fourier domain now, right? So we pick a mode k, and then for that mode k, it is sufficient to know what the mode function's amplitude is at one point in time, and what its derivative is, time derivative is at that point in time. And we don't have spatial behavior here, we just fix the k. Okay, so three things are equivalent. Namely, picking two numbers for the initial condition and time derivative of a mode function. So picking what the amplitude of a mode function is at the time and what its derivative is at the time. This is equivalent to picking the mode function, to specifying what it does everywhere. Because if you have its amplitude and derivative at a point in time, then the Klein-Gödel equation allows you to calculate what it does at all time, right? Okay, so far we have that two things are equivalent. Picking two numbers for the initial condition is equivalent to specifying the mode function at all times. And picking a mode function is equivalent to specifying a vector zero. In our case, the vector we believe to be the vacuum state. All of this is still not resolving the mystery how we identify the vacuum state. I'm only saying that identifying the vacuum state as the vector zero, as a vector zero, is the same as picking mode function, which is the same as picking the initial conditions at some point in time eta, an amplitude and a derivative of the mode function. This needs to be spelled out explicitly because we will keep using this for a little while. To specify the vacuum state will boil down to specifying two numbers per mode, namely the initial conditions for a mode function, which then implies the mode function, which then implies the A operator, which then implies the state that it annihilates, which is the vacuum. So whatever physical criterion, you see, math cannot tell us what the vacuum state is, the physics has to. Whatever physical criterion we come up with for identifying which state is the no particle state, it will translate into a criterion for choosing two numbers, right? Namely the amplitude and the derivative of the mode function. I mean, for each mode, right? Okay, so let's say we want to know what is, at time eta, the vacuum state. At time eta, which state in the Hilbert space is the no particle state at that point in time. Then what we can do is to search for a criterion, a physically motivated criterion, to pick the amplitude of our mode function at that time, let's call it R, okay? And also the time derivative of our mode function at that time. So our ambition now is to identify by physical reasoning what the vacuum state is and then express it as a choice of the initial conditions of the mode functions at time eta. It's just a mathematical handle. Because ultimately it's all good and fine to wave hands and say the vacuum state ought to be blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, we have to turn this into a concrete way to express it mathematically. And so the most convenient way for that is to say that for every mode, we need to pick two numbers. And for example, we can pick them at the time eta where we're interested in identifying the vacuum state. We could also pick it at some other time, but since we are interested in the vacuum at time eta, we might as well set the boundary conditions or initial conditions for the mode function at that time. Okay, so once we've chosen these numbers, Rk and Sk, we have implicitly fixed the mode function, we have fixed the A operator that comes with it, and therefore a vector in the Hilbert space. And our ambition is to choose the R and the S in such a way that the vector zero that's annihilated by this A then is with good reason considered, or can be considered with good reason to be the no particle state. So now to the physics of it. How do we identify that supposed no particle state, the vacuum state, in the Hilbert space? Well, first attempt at this is this. Let us try to define the vacuum state at the time eta as that Hilbert space vector, which at the time eta minimizes the Hamiltonian. So that's that idea of which we already know it's not going to work, but we should try it at least. So we try to minimize the energy. That means we have a very concrete thing to do now, namely, in order to make that mathematically explicit, we will now do this. we will calculate for every mode, for every k, two numbers r and s, which when chosen to be the amplitude and time derivative of the amplitude of a mode function at time eta, specifies through the dynamics of the Klein-Gödel equation a mode function such that the associated AK operator annihilates a vector zero, which is the state of lowest energy. Okay? So the state of lowest energy is annihilated by some A operator that is associated with a mode function, and that mode function takes a certain amplitude and time derivative of the amplitude at time eta, and those amplitude and time derivative are the numbers rk and sk. So what we need to do now is calculate the energy, calculate the ground state energy of the Hamiltonian, or the ground state actually. We calculate the ground state of the Hamiltonian as a function of the mode function. And then we choose the mode function such as to minimize it. So we calculate explicitly, we calculate the expectation value of the vector zero of the Hamiltonian as a function of what this vector zero is, because this vector zero depends on which mode function we use. So then we write here the vector zero and we play through all possible choices of mode functions. It's not so bad because it's just a three-dimensional choice per mode. All possible choices of mode functions and check which mode function do we have to choose such that the energy expectation is lowest. And then that mode function has a certain amplitude and time derivative of the amplitude at the time eta, and these are the two numbers that we read off, r and s. And we can do that at any point in time. So that means at any point in time, we can calculate by this method a mode function for each mode such that the energy is minimized at that point in time. And in a way, that would be the most natural thing to do, right? To simply assume no particles, lowest energy. It's not going to be quite right, but let's try it. Okay, so we take the expectation value of the energy of the Hamiltonian for the vector zero. Now, which vector that is, we haven't quite decided yet, because we haven't decided on the mode function yet. All right, so let us calculate what that is. For that, we substitute in the expression for the Hamiltonian that we calculated earlier. All of this stuff here. Where remember, this is just the usual Klein-Gödel term. The mass term picks up a scale factor, and then we have this new term that comes from the acceleration of the universe. And here, the chi field can be expressed in terms of mode functions and A and A dagger operators. Well, after we Fourier transform it. This is still in space, but we will Fourier transform this. So in particular, we use that the chi of x can be written as chi of k, and we plug that, we substitute that in here. So we do the Fourier transform and substitute the expression of the field in terms of mode functions and creation and annihilation operators. And then here, this is what we get when we substitute all of that in. So the expectation value of the Hamiltonian for a state zero depends on which state zero that is in this way. So here is the Hamiltonian again, But in the Hamiltonian, we did the Fourier transform, and then we expressed the chi field in terms of the mode functions and the creation and annihilation operators. So this is full of mode functions and creation and annihilation operators. And we see, for example, that this term is not going to contribute because we have an annihilation operator acting on this. Also, these guys act on this, so they're all going to go away. And the only terms that are left over after these cancellations here is this. See, we get some terms with a dagger a and a dagger, and they will survive coming from here. So what we get is that the expectation value of the Hamiltonian is this expression. And why does it depend on the mode function, on the choice of mode function? Well, because every choice of mode function comes with its choice of a and a daggers. And each choice of a and a daggers comes with the corresponding state zero. Right? If you choose a different a, let's say if you choose a tilde, you get a vector zero tilde, etc. So no wonder that this expectation value depends on the choice of mode function. Oh, and by the way, remember that omega k is the oscillation frequency of the harmonic oscillator of the mode k. And it is, just to remind you, this expression here. In Minkowski space, that term would be absent because there's no acceleration of space-time in Minkowski space. And that term would be simply k squared plus m squared, because a squared is 1 in Minkowski space. But in an expanding space-time, we need to be careful with this, because the frequency squared could go negative, right? Because this term could dominate over that, and that will be cosmologically very important. But for now, let us look at regular simple particle creation without this term dominating. It turns out that structure formation in cosmology doesn't come from simply beta coefficients producing particles. It's not like the galaxy formation was seeded by the creation of inflaton particles. Actually, the big deal in cosmology is that term. When that term flips the sign, that's going to be the most important mechanism. But before we get to this, let's just look at what expansion on its own can do without the flipping of the sign in terms of particle creation. Okay, so what we assume here is that the omega squared is still positive, so that we just have regular harmonic oscillators here and not inverted ones. Because the inverted ones wouldn't have a minimum energy. But as long as omega squared is positive, as long as the acceleration doesn't dominate, we can find a minimum here. Remember the coefficients rk and sk being the amplitude of the mode function and the time derivative of the mode function? Remember that once we know those two numbers, we can use the Klein-Gordon equation to get the mode function everywhere. It's just the initial conditions for a mode function, or initial conditions at time eta 1, and we can calculate what the mode function does everywhere. So as we said, the energy of the state 0 depends on the mode function we choose. But the mode function depends on the initial conditions. So therefore, we should be able to express that energy in terms of the coefficients r and s. Because all the information about the mode functions is in r and s. Okay. So concretely then, what we need to do is to take the expression of the energy expectation in our huge box, which is this, and then re-express it, using the initial conditions of R and S. And that's pretty straightforward. Namely, what we obtain is that the energy expectation value is then given by, remember that V prime is the S, And the V is the R. It's simply the sum of the SS star plus omega squared R, R star. So what we want, of course, is a choice of mode function such that the energy is minimized. Right? We are following the simple-minded idea that the vacuum state might be the lowest energy state. If that's correct, if the physics of that is correct, we are working out the math of it now. So that would mean that we have to choose that mode function which has initial conditions S and R such that this is as small as it can be. Now you might wonder, well, what if I just choose R and S equal to zero? Wouldn't that do the trick? That would pretty much make this as small as it could be. No, you can't. Because remember that mode functions have to obey not only the Klein-Gordon equation, which would be easy to obey. The function zero obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. It's a linear equation. No, the mode functions also have to obey the Wronskian condition in order to ensure that the canonical commutation relations hold. And the Wronskian condition is not linear. It will force the S and the R to be non-zero. So we need to minimize that expression subject to the Wronskian condition. You see, the Klein-Gordon equation is a given here because these are simply the initial conditions. Whatever initial conditions we choose, we can get a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation from that. No, what we have to make sure is that the R and S are chosen compatible with the Wronskian condition. And the Wronskian condition in terms of R and S is this one. So what we are ending up with is a problem of constraint optimization or constraint minimization. We want to minimize that expression subject to the constraint that the Wronskian condition holds. And that, of course, can be done with the method of a Lagrange multiplier. So we write down some function that we want to minimize, namely this, which is the energy, plus Lagrange multiplier times the constraint. So when we do this, we have to solve two equations. We have to solve that the function that we want to minimize differentiated with respect to the parameters S and R is zero because it's a minimum. And the two equations that we get from that, it's like the Euler Lagrange equations, are these. And then we also have, from differentiating with respect to lambda, the Lagrange multiplier, the constraint equation to solve. Now, if you have a bit of time on your hands, you can work this out yourself, what the solution to this is, but it's just simple algebra. And what you find is that the solution is given by this. The coefficients R and K are these. Here, omega K is the frequency of the harmonic oscillators, mode K. And e to the power I theta is some phase. The theta is arbitrary. It doesn't matter. Whatever we choose for the theta, you get a solution here. And we might as well choose the theta to be zero. It makes no difference which choice we make. That's just an overall phase, just like in quantum mechanics, you can always have an overall phase of your state. See, if you take a mode function and multiply it with a phase, you still describe the same vector zero, because the annihilation operator will annihilate the same vector zero. All right, so we found it. This is, we are harvesting here the result of the following exercise. We came up with a physical argument for identifying which state in the Hilbert space is the no particle state. The physical argument was, it's the lowest energy state. And then we translated that into a mathematical way to pick out the right mode function such that the associated A operator annihilates that state in the Hilbert space. And how do we pick that mode function? Well, at the time eta, where we want to describe the vacuum, at the time eta, that mode function has to have this amplitude and that time derivative. So now we can apply that to any kinds of expanding spacetimes. At any point in time, we can calculate now the lowest energy state very easily. See, we just look at where are we, and I mean, we pick a point in time, and then we ask, okay, where is the frequency of our harmonic oscillator at that point in time? What is omega k? Remember, omega k depends on time in general. For example, because of this acceleration term in there. So we obtain these coefficients in a time-dependent way. And then whenever we want to know which state is the lowest energy state, easy. We just work out what omega k is at that point in time, and then we calculate the mode function that has this amplitude and that time derivative at that point in time. That mode function comes with an A operator that annihilates the state that is the lowest energy state at that point in time. So we're dropping the phase now, right? So we drop this phase because it's irrelevant. And then what we obtain as a conclusion is that if we apply these conditions on a mode function at some time eta 1, then the evolution of the Klein-Gordon equation gives us a mode function. I mean, these are just the initial conditions, and then from them, using the evolution of the Klein-Gordon equation, we get a full mode function vk of eta. And then when we express the quantum field in terms of these mode functions v and v star, then that operator A is going to annihilate a vector 0, which, as we've just guaranteed, is the lowest energy state at time eta 1. And we are guessing for now that that is the vacuum state, the no particle state. So the lowest energy state at a given point in time is also called the instantaneous ground state, or the instantaneous lowest energy state at time eta 1. Let's see if all of this makes sense in Minkowski space, where we know what it should be. So Minkowski space is the special case where the scale factor is just 1 for all time. Then frequency function for the harmonic oscillator is simply k squared plus m squared and is constant. Also, the conformal time is just the proper time on your wristwatch in Minkowski space. There's no difference. Now, from our calculations, from our hard work just now, we can conclude that the vector 0 is the state of lowest energy at a time eta 1 if we choose the mode functions to be such that they obey these initial conditions at the time eta 1. Right? Just given by the frequency of the harmonic oscillator. Now, since the frequency of the harmonic oscillator doesn't depend on time in Minkowski space, this is always the same condition. So we can already conclude from that that what the state that is the vacuum state at one time is also the state that is the vacuum state at another time, because the same condition is to be met. Now, what is that mode function that we are picking out here? Which mode function obeys the condition that its amplitude at some time eta 1 is 1 over square root of omega k, and its time derivative is I times square root of omega k? And the answer is, of course, this exponential here, up to an irrelevant constant global phase in front of it. And I wrote it twice, once with the conformal time, once with the proper time. It doesn't matter because in Minkowski space, the two definitions of time are the same. Now, if you remember, that's how it looked like in Minkowski space too, as the way we defined it earlier. So I leave it to you as an exercise to verify that the state that we get in this way, and in particular that the mode function that we have is the same that we had earlier. Now let's return to our ansatz. The answer was, the idea, the proposal, the hypothesis was that at some arbitrary time, eta 1, the vacuum state, in the sense of the no particle state, is that state which is the lowest energy state at that time. Right? So that was the physics behind it. The no particle state is the lowest energy state. But if that's so, then that implies predictions. Right? It implies that as the universe expands, and therefore the Hamiltonian is time dependent, and therefore the ground state is time dependent, what is the vacuum state now is not the vacuum state later, and we get particle production. In fact, we already have all the machinery to calculate the unitary transformation from one basis to the other basis, Bogoliubov-Beta coefficients, and the whole shebang, right? Now, if you work that out, as which you can, you find an enormous amount of particle production. You find that with the expansion rate of the universe now, there ought to be about 10 particles produced by this mechanism per cubic kilometers per year per species of particle, just by order of magnitude. The 10 particles per cubic kilometer. Doesn't sound like it's a lot, like 10 particles in this room wouldn't be much. But let's see how many particles are there in the universe on average. Well, it turns out that in the universe there are, at present, about 1 billion particles per cubic kilometers. Okay, so now give this 10 billion years. Right, so the universe is older than that, but just by order of magnitude, 10 billion years. That would mean that we have 10 to the 10 particles created by this mechanism, and just only by this mechanism, which means that 10 times more particles than we actually see would have been created just by this process of time dependence of the scale factor of the universe. That's way too much. Especially because we think where the matter that we have is coming from, and not from that. Now, Einstein believed that the universe, initially he believed, that the universe was in a steady state. That the universe might be expanding, but, I mean, initially he just thought it might be in a steady state. But then he thought maybe it's expanding, but has always been expanding, and particles are somehow being produced all the time. But now we know that there was a Big Bang. So this could not be a replenishing. And since this is so much, it would not go unnoticed. We would see the signature of this kind of particle production. This means we need to reconsider the way we identify physically which state is the no particle state. Now for that, let us remember that any quantum system does not get excited if we change its parameters very slowly. That's the notion of quantum adiabaticity. If, for example, you take a harmonic oscillator, a quantum harmonic oscillator, and you change its backdriving force constant very slowly, then it doesn't get excited. In fact, the adiabatic theorem says something more sophisticated. Imagine you have a harmonic oscillator, this is its potential, and it is in its fifth excited state. And now you make the harmonic oscillator steeper, and then you make it wider, and so on. And you do this really slowly. It turns out that the harmonic oscillator will stay in its fifth excited state. Only if you do this quickly, and by quickly is meant quick as compared to the resonance frequency of the harmonic oscillator. Like if the resonance frequency is omega, then there is an associated time scale, 1 over omega, And if you do this at a time scale that's much longer than 1 over omega, then you're in the adiabatic regime and you're not getting excitation. This is the principle by which adiabatic quantum computing, by the way, works. Right, so we don't get excitation if the system changes slowly enough. So here I'm just saying that it has to be slow compared to the natural resonance frequency of the harmonic oscillator. So since the university, maybe the university expands too, that would be great. Also, I would hope it to expand a little faster than the universe. So since the universe presently expands slowly, we should expect essentially no particle production. And indeed, we don't see any evidence for it from that mechanism, at least experimentally. So how can we improve our answers for the identification of the vacuum state? You see, we have a lot of mathematical machinery, but it seems that there's a problem with the physics of it. Simply saying no particle state means no energy means lowest energy state seems to be too simple. Okay, so let's do a preliminary consideration. Consider models where the universe is initially Minkowski and then undergoes an expansion which is slow, which is adiabatic. So it's Minkowski space, and then the universe slowly starts to expand in a way such that all the mode oscillators may change frequency, but not dramatically fast. They change their frequency slowly compared to their natural resonance frequency. Then we would expect that there's essentially no particle creation. So the vacuum state, once we identified, should always be essentially the same Hilbert space vector in this case. And that means that just like in Minkowski space, where we saw that the criterion for identifying the mode function is the same now and later, and therefore there's no particle production. Similarly, we would expect that whenever the universe is expanding adiabatically, when it is expanding slowly, we would expect that in this circumstance, the vacuum identification criterion should pick out always the same mode function, no matter at what time you do it. Right? Now, that wasn't true for the lowest energy pick. That was different. But this is going to be the guiding principle now, to say that whatever the vacuum identification criterion is, when applied in an adiabatic scenario, it should, to at least very good approximation, always pick out the same mode function. Because if it picks the same mode function, the associated vacuum state is the same always. And that means we don't have that the vacuum state changes. It's the same thing, and there's no particle creation. So what we are looking for now, that's the improved criterion, it's the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion, is for a mathematical prescription to pick out mode functions, technically to pick out the R and S coefficients, the initial conditions. We want to pick a condition that holds no matter at what time we pick it, if the universe is expanding adiabatically. By the way, when I taught this class 2 years ago, there were two students in the course, and we wrote a paper that appeared 3 weeks ago. And in that paper, we, among other things, show that that criterion is equivalent to another criterion, which is maybe even a bit more plausible. Namely, remember, our first attempt was to say the vacuum state and no particle state is the state of lowest energy. Doesn't quite work. But how about this? Imagine you have your space-time filled with particles. Imagine it's not the vacuum state, it's the state with particles. Then such a state can be distinguished from the vacuum state by the observation that if there are particles, then as the universe expands, they're going to be diluted. Whereas the vacuum state doesn't get diluted, right? So you see what I mean? Whenever you have particles, then if the universe is expanding or shrinking, it will mess with the density of particles. So that state is changing, right? So the vacuum state is the only fixed point in that regard. It's a state that is not subject to dilution. And so what we showed is that you can view the adiabatic vacuum state or adiabatic vacuum identification criterion also as picking that state as the vacuum state, which is the least susceptible to dilution. All right. Okay, but coming back to the technical part, what we need to do is to formulate the physical intuition mathematically. So the physical intuition is that we want to identify the vacuum as, and we want a vacuum identification criterion which is picking out the same mode function at all times so that we don't have any particle creation because the associated A operators are always the same, so therefore the associated zero vector is always the same, so therefore there's no Bogoliubov transformations and so on, no basis change. We want this to happen, namely that the vacuum identification criterion picks out the same mode function at all times whenever the universe is expanding in an adiabatic way, in a slow way, in a way that's slow compared to the natural frequency of the modes. And we need to put math to that. So how can we find this mode function? How can we what is the proper way to identify that mode function? What is the proper vacuum identification criterion? What is the proper mode function identification criterion? Such that the criterion is always the same when the universe is expanding adiabatically. Okay, remember, we were looking at the case of Minkowski space here. Just a sec. Okay, so let's say that the universe starts out with an early phase of Minkowski space and then changes adiabatically. So if the universe starts out Minkowski space, we know what the vacuum state then was. It was given by a mode function which had this simple form, which is we had it at the beginning of the course and we just rederived it like 15 minutes ago. Okay, so this is the mode function that picks out as its vector zero the vacuum state of Minkowski space. Okay. Now, the universe is now allowed to expand adiabatically. The Klein-Gordon equation can now be used to evolve the VK in time forward. Now, we're not saying that the universe stays Minkowski space. It's not going to be trivial. This function is going to change because the universe is expanding. It's just expanding slowly. And you can ask, well, what is the solution then? It turns out you can write it down in full generality. Namely, if the universe starts out in Minkowski space, and therefore the mode function is this one, then that mode function evolves as the universe keeps expanding adiabatically. It evolves and is described by this expression. And first of all, notice that if there is no time evolution of the universe, if it's not expanding, then the omega k is constant, and then that integral just becomes this, right? Because you have eta naught to eta, it's just exactly that, right? And well, that's just a constant, so if omega is not time dependent, if the universe is not having any time dependent scale factor or whatever, then this formula is this one. And then if the universe is expanding adiabatically, slowly, then with a very good approximation, and the approximation theory you can find, It would take too long to go into the approximation theory for that. But for example, we cover it in our paper that came out 3 weeks ago, but it's also in textbook. Also in the paper, we do it quite in some detail. So this is a very good approximation if the universe is expanding adiabatically of what the mode function does. If it starts out like this and then the evolution is adiabatic, this is the solution at all time. And you see, this is great because now we can say, we want a vacuum identification criterion that picks out always the same mode function if the universe is expanding adiabatically. So we need a vacuum identification criterion that picks out always this mode function. Right? That's what we need. And so therefore we need to find out what condition on the amplitude and derivative picks out that mode function no matter when we do it. That's going to be the improved condition for the amplitude and the derivative. That's going to be the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion. So, first of all, what do we mean by adiabatic? Just to make the assumptions clear, we say that a mode K evolves adiabatically, the universe is expanding slowly enough, if the first derivative is small enough and the second derivative is small enough. You may wonder, why do we have these fancy denominators here? Well, you see, if you say that this is small, it makes no sense because this quantity has units. And a quantity with units is never small or large because you can choose different units to make it huge or small. You always have to make things dimensionless to be able to say it's small. So the natural thing to say that it's small is to divide by some other quantity made out of it that has the same units, and in this case it's omega squared, because the omega has 1 over time and omega prime is 1 over time squared, and so this is just, you know, same units, and here the same thing. So basically we're saying the universe is expanding slowly for that mode, for that mode's evolution, if the first derivative and the second derivative are small in natural units. So this is AC, the adiabaticity criterion. Right, and you can work it out yourself that under these conditions, the expression that we wrote down for the solution, this one, solves the Klein-Gordon equation. Right? Okay, so under these conditions, we have the solution. Now, is the initial Minkowski period really necessary? Not really. So we try to identify the mode functions whose associated vector zero is the adiabatically defined vacuum without referring to what the mode function would look like at an earlier Minkowski period of the universe. All of this is just to say that we can just work with the expression that we have. This one, whether or not the universe started with a Minkowski period. You see, it's not plausible that the universe started with a Minkowski period. The Big Bang didn't look like Minkowski space, as far as we know. Right. So what we can do now is simply take the solution, where is it? Here, this one, right? That's the solution to the Klein-Gordon equation at all times, if the universe expands adiabatically. And we can simply ask, okay, so what is the amplitude at a particular point in time? What is the time derivative at a particular point in time? What is the criterion for those such that the criterion is met at all times by this function? Because that is going to be our adiabatic vacuum identification criterion. And here it is. What we have is that at any point in time, the amplitude of our mode function is given by this up to a generic phase. Doesn't matter, it's just a prefactor. And the time derivative of the mode function is given by this. And you see the non-triviality in this here, right? This term was not there in the older vacuum identification criterion where we guessed that maybe the vacuum might be the state of lowest energy. So this adiabatic vacuum identification criterion is a little bit different from the ground state vacuum identification criterion. But they start coinciding, of course, when you drop the change of parameters. If this thing is zero, then you just get this divided by the square root, and it gets back to the same thing as before. But we get an extra term here. And that, it turns out, is important, because it ensures that we are not predicting particle creation as long as the universe is expanding just smoothly. So, for example, at the moment, the universe is expanding pretty adiabatically, so we wouldn't expect a significant amount of particle creation. Okay, so the general adiabatic vacuum identification criterion is then this. Consider an arbitrary time eta 1. Assume that the evolution of the universe, and therefore of the frequency of all the mode functions, is adiabatically slow, particularly for the mode k in question. I keep saying slow and adiabatic for a mode because, remember that whether or not the evolution of the universe is adiabatic is a statement of a relative speed, right? If you look at harmonic oscillators that have a tremendously slow frequency, well, then the universe might be changing quickly relative to them. Whereas if you look at modes for really short wavelengths, really fast oscillations, then the universe is for sure slow compared to that. So some modes may be in the adiabatic regime and others are not. Okay, so consider an arbitrary time eta 1. Assume that the evolution of omega k is adiabatically slow for mode k at time eta 1. We then identify that state as the vacuum state, that is to say, as the no particle state at the time eta 1, whose mode function vk is specified by these conditions here. But of course, we attempted to, and one would generally do this, to apply that vacuum identification criterion, not only when the universe is expanding adiabatically, but in general. And then we can actually predict a significant amount of particle production if that happens. Okay, and the so obtained state zero, by that means, is called the adiabatic vacuum, and that's the definition that we use in cosmology nowadays. Okay, let's compare. Just a remark. Recall that the criteria for choosing the mode function such that the vacuum state is the lowest energy state, this criterion was given by those two equations. And they are a little bit different from the equations that we saw with the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion, because the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion has another term over here, which involves the time derivative of omega. Right. Okay. Now I know that was a bit difficult perhaps today, but I tried to do it very carefully. Okay. Any questions? Okay. Well, then have a nice weekend. See you on Tuesday. And stay safe.